Welcome to Hack the Entrepreneur, the show which reveals the fears, habits, and inner battles behind big-name entrepreneurs and those on their way to joining them. Now here is your host, John Naster.
Hey, hey, this is Hack the Entrepreneur. Thank you so much for joining me again today. We've got a great show for you today. It's maybe veers a little bit differently than some of the episodes, but I think you're going to dig it. So let's jump into it. So I was introduced to my guest way back in 1998 or 1999, somewhere in there. But just prior to that, in 1996, he started a part-time mail-order business out of his bedroom in Cleveland, Ohio. This mail-order business eventually became Microcosm Publishing, an independent publisher and distributor. During the past 20-plus years, Microcosm has relocated to Portland and has grown significantly with countless ups and downs and changes in the way books are sold and consumed. Then in his 30s, my guest was diagnosed with autism. Through all of this, he's learned a lot of what and what not to do, so he put it down in a book called Good Trouble, Building a Successful Life and Business with Asperger's. Now, let's hack Joe Beal. When it comes to marketing your business, it's all about reaching the right audience at the right time. And it's about connecting with them when your message will resonate the most. So if you want to target your customers where they are every day and when they are ready to make a decision, LinkedIn can help you. When you advertise on LinkedIn, it's the world's largest professional network, in case you didn't know, you have the opportunity to build long-term relationships with your customers. Relationships that often translate into high-quality leads, website traffic, and higher brand awareness. So what's the first step? It's talking to the right audience. Well, every day, over 500 million professionals engage with content on LinkedIn, and chances are your future customers are among them. And the best part is you can start for free today. To redeem a free $100 LinkedIn ad credit, go to linkedin.com/hack. That's linkedin.com/hack for your free $100 ad credit. Yes, some terms and conditions apply, but there's $100 in advertising money waiting for you at linkedin.com/hack. Today's episode of Hack the Entrepreneur is brought to you by 2020. It's where creative minds get authentic, real-world stock photos. If you're looking to positively inspire your audience on social media or on your website, and I know you are, you're going to want to use engaging, fresh photos that are unique. Well, 2020, they've crowdsourced millions of exclusive photos from a community of over 350,000 photographers, and it's all available under a simple, royalty-free license. And today, they are offering you, a listener of Hack the Entrepreneur, a 5-photo free trial. To start yours right now, go to 2020.com/hack. That's the word 20, then 20.com/hack to get 5 free photos today. We're back with another episode of Hack the Entrepreneur. And today we have a very, very special guest. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Oh, man. It's all my pleasure. All my pleasure. I'm glad we're getting to sit down and do this. And I think we're going to have a lot of fun. So let's just jump into it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Joe. You do many things. Today we're talking to Joe, the entrepreneur. So as an entrepreneur, Joe, can you tell me, what's the one thing that you do that you feel has been the biggest contributor to your successes so far?
You know, and it's like something that I came across without even thinking about it. And it's that I was born with autism. I have throughout my entire life rejected rules that do not make sense towards the goal. And for most of my life, that got me in pretty deep trouble. But as an entrepreneur, it's rewarded. It's celebrated. It's, you know, it's the one thing that makes you successful, you know, because it's like the rules are off the table and or other people are not playing by the rules.
Yes. Why this is a real sort of common theme through people who are creating things, I think, and putting them out into the world, whether that's businesses or any sort of creations. It's sort of that lack of wanting to put up with those rules. But I think we need to get into this. So you wrote a book about this, and now it's part of sort of your one thing. This is this sort of discovery about yourself, I believe, later in life too, right?
Yeah, I didn't find out that I had autism until I was 32, which is pretty late, but not late for, you know, I'm a Gen Xer, so it's actually not very late for me because it didn't exist when I was a child. There's a really elaborate, weird history of it, of autism in the United States that kind of connects to a lot of stigma and just a lot of just weird ideas about the kind of stemming from Nazi Germany and our understanding of like how disabled people would be dealt with, especially people like us that are developmentally disabled rather than intellectually disabled. And so the stigma of that kind of prevented it from having like clear diagnostic criteria in the United States until between 1990 and 1994, when they really had cemented it. But by that point, I was grown. You know, I was moving on with my life. I was doing punk rock stuff. And so I wrote a book about it, which is called Good Trouble: Building a Successful Life and Business with Asperger's, which is the slightly outdated word. Now it's all lumped in just as autism. And so that kind of looks at all those sort of painful learning from mistakes as well as fruitful benefits of that. And so I have a lot, you know, and I never really had thought about it from like a business point of view or anything like that until I was writing the book. And then that was sort of the first time, because, you know, people had always made jokes to me about it where they were like, oh, you're successful because you're approaching things with a different mindset. And I was always like, ha ha ha. But then, you know, the more I dug deep and the more I looked at like specific circumstances and things like that, I was like, they're kind of right.
They are kind of right. So this is interesting. So forgive my absolute ignorance on autism. I didn't even know that it used to be called Asperger's and now it's autism. But I mean, I would guess that you probably didn't have the depth of knowledge about it before you were diagnosed with it.
You would think that, but
oh, okay.
Incorrect assumption, which is almost the funniest thing about it. Because so I had a friend who is also one of our authors, Dave Roach, who was a public school teacher in Portland, where I live now, who grew up and, you know, that was his, still is his career. And he wrote a book about it called Unsubbing that sort of detailed his experience with special needs kids in the public school system. And so he would come over after school to our office and we would hang out and, you know, talk about that. And that eventually led to him writing a book that we published in 2004. Even years before that, he would come by and, you know, and he told me about Asperger's and autism and developmental disability and these things. And it was the first time I had ever really given it serious thought, but that more led to, you know, I was in my late 20s at the time and I had a lot of thoughts where I was, you know, we would joke about it that I had it because, you know, I did have all of the symptoms, all of the diagnostic criteria, but it was just a joke because, you know, obviously if I had it, somebody would have, you know, some adult somewhere in my life would have pulled me aside and identified and flagged that. But so it wasn't until many years later they actually did diagnose me professionally. And it was, in many ways, it's the most satisfying thing because then it makes everything in the rearview mirror of your life, you know, especially like things that are really confusing or things that are like really painful failures. It makes them all make sense, you know, which I think is kind of a universal human thing, like it is what you want. You know, you like need to sort of process your emotions and understand why things happened the way that they did. And, you know, just kind of sort of make peace with all that stuff, which I think a lot of people don't. They're sort of at like a forward motion, you know, 110% all the time. They just don't put the value into that, that I think that they should.
Yeah, I think you're right. And this making it make sense I guess this is sort of a perfect time to do it. I haven't actually like said this publicly, but like a month and a half ago, I was officially diagnosed with ADD, which everybody jokes about the fact that all entrepreneurs are like that. And people had sort of made that joke about me in passing. And I would sort of say it like just off the cuff. But I interviewed a guy who wrote a book called Faster Than Normal, which was about him being diagnosed in his 30s with ADD. And then how he sort of figured out his life and built businesses off of this. And during the conversation, I was just like, wow. And I read his book and I was like, this is insane. Like this, this is like me. And so I went through the process, but yeah, lots of it makes sense. But I think all I want to say is I think that the value of these conversations comes from those, because if you don't have somebody around you or that you're exposed to that may have this, I don't think you can become aware of it in yourself. And then it's true. You can fall into these sort of failures in your life that don't make any sense.
Right. Yeah. And I think there is a lot of people out there that don't understand the value of a diagnosis, especially in adulthood, middle age. And I would really push them. You know, I meet a lot of people now. I mean, I get that was the thing that I never really counted on with the, you know, because this is my seventh book. But this is the first one where, you know, it came out over 2 years ago and I'm still getting weekly fan mail, and it's very personal fan mail, you know. And so it's a lot of people that are young people that are kind of looking for mentorship, or older people that are looking to sort of commiserate, or punk rock people that are trying to diagnose themselves. And you know, and so I think that the thing I really push people to do is like get the diagnosis, like the understanding of your, you know, if nothing else, to know who you are and maybe like be able to make better decisions and just have better information going forward.
Yeah, it's profound. The sort of change in the way you think about yourself and the way you're doing things. Or it has been for me. I shouldn't say that it is in general. So diagnosed at 32, how old are you now?
I'm 40.
You're 40. Okay, so I'm 40. So we're the exact same age. And I was diagnosed at 40. With
oh,
ADD.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it was shocking, I mean, to my mother and all that stuff, because she's upset that it didn't happen earlier. But I was of that time where it wasn't diagnosed when we were younger.
Right.
Is now. So 40 years old, at 18, you started a publishing company. Oh, you didn't even know, I don't think, that it was going to be a publishing company at that point. But you started what it is that you're still doing today, 22 years later. Can you tell us what that is and how that happened?
Sure. So I was, well, let's see. So I founded Microcosm Publishing in 1996 in sort of, I had grown up in punk rock and I had been sort of drinking to cope with my undiagnosed autism and sort of kind of fumbling through life. You know, I was an at-risk kid and I wasn't really parented. My dad was pretty severely physically disabled from the time I was about 5 or 6. And then, so I, and our household was like pretty violent. And so I spent as much time away from home as I possibly could. And that led me to like the comic book store and then the bookstore and the record store. And then I basically, by the time I was a teenager, I was hanging out at this, in the United States, we have like a strong underground punk rock contingent where basically adult teenagers kind of fill the role of adults a lot of times and open these clubs that are not really clubs. They don't really have permitting or things like that. And so we had opened one of those on the near west side of Cleveland in what was once at that time like a pretty rough neighborhood. And then I was involved in that from about the time that I was 16 or 17. And by the time I was 18, I was like becoming more and more visionary, where I was like, okay, there's like all this like incredibly experimental music and like really performative interpretation of it and like really loose guidelines. But it kind of creates like an ethical core that is a little more than the music. You know, there's a lot of politics. You know, they would come in and promote like, you know, things against like police brutality. They would have protests that we would be involved in by just being on the periphery of that. So before long, I was like, we, the royal we, the collective we, should have like a publishing arm of punk rock. And so that apparently, I have no recollection of this, but apparently I told a guy who was a few years older than me, who is probably still a few years older than me, that I had these these ideas, and that I had this sort of moment where I was like, I'm going to start something, and it's going to be like my life's work. And I'm like a 16 or 17 year old kid at this time, bear in mind, you know, and I'm like falling over drunk, you know, so bear that in mind as well.
It's a good time to
and
say.
That, I mean, I feel like when you're that age, that's the only time you would be that pompous, I hope, in life, you know. And then I ran into him a few years ago in L.A., where he's now still a promoter, but probably getting paid for it now. And he reminded me of this conversation, and I was like, I don't remember that at all. And he's like, but you did it. You actually did the thing. And he's correct. So by the time I was 18, I had founded Microcosm Publishing, which was more or less exactly that. Weirder, it's still more or less exactly that, you know? And there's definitely, I've learned a lot in that time, and the application of the ideas is a lot broader, because I think at that time I really had no idea of like things like audience. I really was developing things in a way that made sense to me. And bear in mind, like, I'm a developmentally disabled teenager alcoholic with like lacked a high school education, you know? So it was like, I wasn't really using what we would today call SEO or keywords, or, you know, I was really just making the people like read every page to get like the substance out of something. And now I guess the biggest thing is that over time I was like, well, I mean, I guess I discovered this by accident, that if you make something and you develop it correctly, people that are outside of your social circle will be just as excited about it as punk rock people. That really took about 10 years to really figure that out in a serious way. But once that caught on, I realized that the sky was kind of the limit, where I was like, I can bring these ideas and these politics and skills and such into like a much more populist realm, if that makes sense.
It does. Absolutely.
But now, I mean, now my like inner teenager is worried that like people might not see our punk rock roots. But so it is funny, because every time I run into somebody from back then, they're like, you can still tell. It's still pretty obvious, you know, and that's, while they might mean that disparagingly, I take that as a comfort.
I would 100% take that as comfort as well. I come from similar roots in that sense. But what is this, if you make something and develop it correctly, people outside of your social circle will sort of like be attracted to it? What does develop it correctly mean?
Sure. So, I mean, I've heard a number of people on your program express this similar concept, is that like the number one failure of businesses is that they are too niche, or conversely, that there is too much competition, that like you are not going to start a competing business against Amazon. At least you're not going to be successful doing that. And then similarly, if you're like only selling furniture that has owl iconography on it in, you know, Northeast South Dakota, you're not going to be successful because you have 10 customers. So you have to sort of develop any product or service to sort of show the emotional payoffs to the person buying it, rather than to you or your ego or to an idea that you had once. Like, you really have to make it about what the person is getting out of it. Because, and especially like in publishing, in art, in music, in, you know, any like sort of art practice, that's the number one problem, is that we have just people that come in the door every single day and they're like, I have an idea, I drew these weird illustrations, will you publish it? And you have to sort of back them up to be like, why would somebody buy this as a book? What are they getting out of it? And that is so hard for so many people, because they're approaching the problem wrong. And I think that is triply true for entrepreneurs, because they just don't approach things that way. They approach it as like, people love apple pie, so I'm going to create a new apple pie franchise, you know? And they, you know, and I get it. It's like, I did an embarrassingly non-existent amount of like market research work plenty of times long after that should be deeply embarrassing, but I can at least preach that that should be done, even if I don't always practice it, you know? And so that's the thing. It's in publishing, the number one question always has to be, what is the emotional payoff to the reader? And if there isn't one, you either need to find one or you need to scrap it and start over.
Wow. What is the emotional payoff to the reader? In podcasting, I guess it's, what is the emotional payoff to the listener?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So this is interesting, though. In publishing or in art, right? I mean, somebody brings the book in and we should publish this. And I think that in art, a lot of people get too sort of self-involved or self-indulged within it, maybe. And I mean, there's obviously use of that because that's how we create, but not also thinking of the end person. But then in business, with the apple pie example, I think entrepreneurs maybe just think too much about, well, that's a massive market. I can just make a ton of money. And they don't actually tie it to themselves, where the artist, I think, ties it way too much to themselves and doesn't tie it to their market.
Yes, I would agree. If there was one thing I just watched be the mistake over and over, it's that. It's one or the other. It's like too personal that they lack the emotional distance to make any sort of reasonable decision. Or there's this idea, there's no emotional attachment. The creator just doesn't care ultimately about what they're making or servicing. And it's so I feel like the successful person can sort of look at that, has that emotional attachment, but can also pull back and look at the data and say, like, oh, this is not working. I need to reevaluate. And I feel like that is an autistic skill, if there ever was one.
Fair enough.
You know.
So I want to just bring this back a bit, because sort of near the beginning of this, you said it was like you grew up in punk rock, and this is where a business you started 22 years ago, I would almost say before the internet, it existed obviously at the time, but I don't even think we all had email addresses at that point. And zines definitely didn't come on the internet at that point, or at least not where I came from up in Canada. Mm-hmm. But this growing up in punk rock, like, what does that mean to you?
Sure. So, and that's the thing. I have had many counselors, social workers, psychologists sort of pose this question to me where they're like, you didn't get raised with a sense of morality because there were no positive role models in your life. And I always stop them at that point and I say, punk rock was my role model and my moral compass and sort of taught me values and ethics at a formative age. And they always are a little dubious and they step back and then they come back and they're like, okay, I could see that. But it was a little late, so I could see how there'd be like some maladaption there. But to me, it's like that taught me all of the skills that I use today, which, you know, is essentially like start small, grow, see what people respond well to. And it kind of taught me to like only pursue things that I'm passionate about. Rather than I've made the example with the apple pie, but you know, we get people all the time that will send us a pitch and they're like, readers love books about zombies, you know, and you're like, but that's not true for one thing. And for another thing, you're like, how is yours different from all the other zombie books? You know? And that is a real example, by the way. And we received that more than once.
People love The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
That's kind of where it ends.
Yeah. And so, but then that creates sort of a saturation problem where you're like, oh, I could write fiction about zombies also that is written for television adaptation. And you're like, we aren't really that publisher. But so, and that's, I guess, what punk rock told me is to never get the dollar signs in my eyes, but to focus on like what I know, what is rewarding, you know, what is the actual prize. And I've obviously. Part, you know, and I guess for people that didn't grow up with that, the weirder thing about growing up in punk rock is that like 13, 14 years old, and I was able to like contact my favorite bands and ask to interview them for my zine. And they would say yes. They didn't say, what are your credentials or qualifications or expertise or, you know, what is the readership of your publication or, you know, any of the questions that a person would ask. Because they sort of had a moral obligation not to ask those questions and to be like, sure, we'll do your zine. And then I show up, I'm a child, they are reasonably in their 20s, so still pretty young, but not completely walking away when they meet me. And I feel like that taught me a lot of self-confidence very young, for better and for worse. And then it taught me as well, like, sort of that I can't waste people's time, that it's not about just meeting with people that I respect and gushing at them, but it's also about honoring that agreement and doing my part towards that goal. And so a lot of that means like researching who I'm talking to and looking at what they've said in interviews, looking at what annoys them, and maybe making some like meta commentary on that. And then by the time I was 16, 17, I was putting out records and doing things, fulfilling like business roles, because honestly, I just felt like those were the parts of punk rock, of do-it-yourself culture in the broadest sense, that people kind of shied away from. They just didn't really, they wanted that to be happening, but it just seemed like nobody really liked to do that work. And I felt like I was specifically suited to do it. And I had sort of the math brain in a maybe overwhelming kind of overworking way. But I could kind of look at it and be like, okay, if the record costs 30 cents a piece, then we could sell it for $3, even with all of our discounts and all of our ads and everything else and mailing and everything else. And it just seemed like that was something that most people like were probably capable of, but just weren't thinking about it in that way. And so that kind of duty fell upon me, and I took it as like an obligation to the scene when I was a teenager. And then it took a really long time to be like, okay, it's okay to have this be my job. And so there's a lot of like what we call punk rock damage, where you like grow up in these rigid systems, and then you have to adulthood is really about like figuring out what parts of your boundaries to learn from, you know, which parts to embrace, which parts to reject. So, like, you know, like part, just like seeing what part of your upbringing is actually serving your goals. And I feel like for a lot of people, that is pretty difficult just because that's not how they're wired. You know, they're really like, oh, I shouldn't do this because it will upset people. And you're like, well, maybe, but you have to kind of think about what you want, and like you're sort of creating a narrative when you let people create submission that way. And so that's the elaborate version of, you know, being raised in punk rock. But I feel like that is ultimately 100% what put me on the course that I'm on.
Right. And I love it. It's super interesting. I mean, it again draws a parallel to things I've done, not in all the same ways at all, but at 40 years old now, both of us, I'm going to assume, because it's with me, obviously, as I was doing that stuff, as I was putting on shows in my own town, because as you say, people wanted it to happen. I wanted it to happen, but most people weren't willing to do it. So I just did it with some friends because I really wanted it to happen. But I didn't realize that I was learning sort of quote unquote business skills or life skills at that time. It wasn't actually until I was in my 30s that I could actually kind of tie it to those things. You know what I mean? You're so caught up. You're just in it. You're doing it. You're not like, at least I wasn't self-aware enough to be like, wow, I'm learning this from the like DIY aesthetic of punk rock. It was just, I was in it doing it.
Right.
So at what point, like just there's people listening that I'm sure are younger and in it themselves, but aren't aware of it. And it would probably be really helpful to know that you're in it before I became aware of it. So when did you become aware of this like formativeness of punk rock in you? And how did that sort of change how you looked at it?
Sure, sure. So yeah, I guess I never, you know, and it's one of those things where when I was in my late, and I hate astrology because it's right, and I hate it that it's right because it should not be correct. It's completely illogical and unrational, and so the fact that it is like actually so pervasive in my life drives me mad. But when I was in my Saturn return and I was 27 to 30, I was having major life changes, as one does. And fortunately, science has this like weird explanation for it too, where they say that like that's the point when like all of your skin cells have changed, or all of your body cellular structure has rebuilt every 7 years. So let's say that. That was actually why I was having that happen at that time. But major life changes, you know, and so I had founded Microcosm in 96, and so by 2007, I had sort of created a system for the employees to own the company and to manage the company and implemented that sort of out of like a political, you know, obligation I had from growing up in punk rock. And, you know, just thinking, and, you know, I mean, it's also like I'm from Cleveland, so there's a strong like labor union background, you know, moral obligation to like owning the means of production and all that that I had grown up in. And, you know, I had many, many, many false assumptions about that, like namely that people would do the homework and create the emotional investment that I had and that it would create a certain outcome. You know, I didn't research other models or anything like that. And the short of the story is that we began that process with $40,000 or $50,000 in savings built up gradually over the years. And then within 6 years, that process had completely drained those savings. And we were about $40,000 in debt on top of that. Ooh. And at that point, but, you know, worse than that, it had kind of driven away the people that were the most invested. And I had quit because it was just like I wasn't just the money. It was just like I was not happy with the way things were being managed. And it was just very much the company had developed a really scarcity mentality rather than sort of moving towards goals and visions. It was really like driven by like, okay, we don't have any money in the bank today, so we need to cancel this project rather than planning forward. It was kind of at that point that people were just quitting left and right, obviously. And it was at that point where the current owner manager offered me to have the company and to work it out. And, you know, it is at that point that it was like, okay, I was like, okay, this was a product of seen damage. Like, I really thought this was the correct way to go. It was not. I learned a tremendous lesson. And, you know, and I was really embarrassed about that for many, many, many years until I listened to just about every other entrepreneur ever tell a very similar story or four similar stories or the story of selling their company and then having to buy it back or, you know, or watching it being run into the ground, you know, while they are the manager, but they can't actually manage the company. And so that really helped me to see that I was not the first person to have suffered such embarrassing setbacks. And you know, and I didn't really process all of that. I quit and I took a good year away from, I wasn't in management meetings or anything else. And so that was all kind of going on. But I spent that year really like evaluating my own life and sort of processing my experiences. And that was when I got diagnosed and also kind of when I got my feet under me and like understood that I was making decisions that guided my life, which, and that's one of the major disabilities of autism is that you don't understand executive function, which is sort of how all of your decisions coalesce to create your life, you know? And so when you can't see that because your brain doesn't understand that, and that has to be a taught skill, it's a little embarrassing for one thing. But for another thing, it's like you can learn cerebrally, intellectually how to overcome that. So I spent that time doing all of those things. And then by the end, so when I got the offer to own and manage the company again, it was kind of like the perfectly aligned time. And I had done like personal work, whatever you'd call it. And then when I wrote Good Trouble, Building a Successful Life and Business with, I wish it was called Autism, I then put in the other 2 or 3 years of work of like sort of digging through the timeline and like my own history and the events of my life. And, you know, that was when I really put my own narrative together and sort of understood how all of these weird circumstances and events had sort of created the fabric of me. And so it really wasn't, and it's kind of a common thing where autistics say that your diagnosis is like the first day that your life begins, you know, because it really does feel that way, because it feels like the first time that you're really in control of what happens to you. And so that's a little bit cheesy, but, you know, I had all the other stuff on top of it too, where I was like, okay, now I get to actually like run the company in a responsible way, because, you know, it had gotten to the point where they were trying to pay people $8 an hour, and it was just not, it was just going to crash and burn, and I had made peace with that, but it would be so much better if it didn't. So really, it's been, you know, and so in many ways, I think some of the staff here forget that we, you know, we've been around for 22 years because it really felt like the last 6 years were so much rebuilding, paying off debts and sort of building better infrastructure and creating better systems and sort of like figuring out what is the perfect amount of independence for each person to have to like, and, you know, and we have a lot of special needs employees as well. And so that kind of helps to sort of be able to create a space for that and sort of celebrate those talents rather than a lot of people have just ongoing horror stories of previous employers that like couldn't understand or appreciate them or worse, like make use of what their actual skills are, because it's so much of traditional employment is like being put into a box and sort of being forced into the shape of that box. So we can be, you know, just a little more flexible here. And then sort of that was when I really figured out that like just the like autistic single-minded purpose and like ability to ignore everything else to like such an absurd degree really did guide me, just like rejecting the rules that reject the goal wasn't, it was getting me in trouble sometimes, but it was also the thing that was sort of making us successful. And then I read an amazing story about a woman who is a therapist who has autism, and she said that we observe 400% more stimulus data than people that have a neurotypical brain do. And so we are just often inundated with information. So for most people, that is why you would see like an autistic person that is sort of, they don't have the coping mechanisms to deal with like sound or sight or various things. And so that's kind of creates that perception. Whereas, you know, she expressed for the first time that she was using this data to like determine when a client was pregnant, for example, before that client even knew that they were pregnant. Or, you know, just to like observe on things. And that was the like sort of the final piece for me when I was like, I do that. I pick up on data patterns before other publishers do. And that's why we're so nimble. And it's like also we've built the stack to be shallow so we can kind of turn on a dime. But even on, in addition to that, like it's also like being able to recognize and act on those patterns.
I love it. I love it. And speaking of planning forward, it's now 2018. You've been at this a long time. What does the industry of independent publishing, zines, books, whatever, records if it is, what does it look like today?
So that's a very good question. And that is probably, that was the biggest change when I came back in 2012, was that once upon a time, by being like the punk rock weirdo publisher, people would just buy whatever you made, buy whatever we made. And that was really fun and really easy. And then you could sort of vet things a little less rigorously. Whereas now, you know, the biggest change is that we primarily, let's be clear, today we primarily publish books. That's like our number one focus. We also distribute books and we do publish zines and we have a podcast and we make films and things like that. But by and large, it's books. And the number one way that book publishing has changed is that it's not, nobody actually reads digital books in any sort of notable numbers. The problem is that the digital printing technologies have just completely oversaturated, supersaturated the market. So today, 8,000 new books will be published. Tomorrow, 8,000 more books will be published. This year, millions of books will be published. And there's tens of millions of books in print from the bestsellers to the people that just won't let go. So all those things together, it creates a very, very crowded marketplace. And so the problem of that is that, let's say you're interested in science fiction. You could never possibly know what science fiction is in print because there's just too much. That it would be a full-time job to keep tabs on new publications. The thing that really is our number one job is title development, which is like, again, telling the reader the emotional payoff and sometimes the sort of structural benefits of each book and making that very clear in the title, making it very clear in the cover, making that the takeaway, because you used to have 5 seconds of somebody's eyeballs in the store, and now that's more like 3 seconds. So that's a lot of data to communicate in that period of time visually. That is mostly the job. You know, when we get a submission, it's, you know, the first question is like, okay, like, is this within our core competencies, like in our wheelhouse? Because, you know, we're not like a nature publisher, or we don't do fantasy books or things like that. But if it is in our wheelhouse, we still have to investigate, like, okay, are there literally tens of thousands of this book already in print? Because there often are. And as a small publisher, like, it's just stupid to compete in that way. Instead, we look at, okay, like, there is a unique angle on this book and it's not in an overcrowded subject. So, like, what's our unique, like, niche? Like, is there an audience? Do we know how to reach this audience? Like, is there an easy plausibility that we could reach 50,000 people, 10% of which would buy this book, and then they would tell their friends, and then they would tell their friends? And that's kind of what is effective. Like, for example, we did a book, Punk Rock Entrepreneur. Seems remarkably relevant. Whoa. The more I talk to you. and you know, and it's very, very, very clear, because there's many, 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 many people like you and I that grew up in it and then sort of reached, let's say, 40 and get to that point where they're like, okay, my photography hobby is something that I've developed to such a skill that I don't just want to, like, go snap photos of bands anymore. I want that to be my job. How do I do that? Or many other people with, you know, we have a book about, like, doing the same thing with an arts practice called Grow, Turn Your Hobby and Passion into Your Job. Those things, there's a clear audience. We know how to reach them. We know where they hang out. We know lots of stuff about them. And the reason that they would buy those books is obvious. Like, the benefit and the emotional payoff is clear. It's the same reason people listen to entrepreneurship podcasts. It's like they have a dream. They, like, aspire to not just maintaining a consistent course that they're on. They want, like, change and disruption of the positive kind, sometimes of also the negative kind, in their life. Those are well-developed. Well, we're going to put a new title and cover on Grow, which, because it's not clear fast enough what it is. And so that's a good example where we're going to retitle it Create. We're going to put a new cover on it, which we've already made. And it'll be like a whole new book, and it will probably do even better than it did. And it did pretty well in its initial 4 years. So, you know, that's a good example. Or, like, Good Trouble is, you know, it's like a book for punk rock people. It's a book for entrepreneur people. It's a book for people that live with autism. It's a book for people that, like, want to connect any number of those things together. And so that was another, you know, or it's a book for fans of Microcosm. So all of those things together, it's a fairly large group of people. There's millions of people with autism, though we probably wouldn't be able to reach them all. So then it's from there, it's like, okay, well, how many could we comprehensibly reach? And how many of them, like, read books, you know? Which is another, you know, sometimes you'll have a subject where there's a huge audience, but they're just too busy to read, or they just couldn't be bothered to care. Or similarly with books that are, like, too didactic or things like that, where you just can't make, because everybody that would be a reader has sort of their own ideas and they see themselves as more of a writer than a reader. And we did a book this past year that's just, like, our bestseller right now, which is called Unfuck Your Brain. And it's about using brain science to, you know, and it's by a doctor of psychology who explains to you in the simplest language, like, how to make your brain work for you instead of against you, and, like, how to rewire things like addiction and, you know, traumatic stress syndrome and things to sort of kind of have the life that you want. And, like, we were talking about, like, how to undo your scene damage and, like, take the parts of that that serve you and then reject the parts of that that are holding you back or crippling you. Because I think for so many people that we did books like this many, many years ago, and they kind of flopped because the audience wasn't ready for it yet. There wasn't a willingness to acknowledge that they needed help or could benefit from resources like this. Whereas today, that was a tremendously successful book and is remains so. Just right, you know, the first minute out of the gate, you know, we sell some every single time we post it on social media or, you know, anywhere else. That kind of comes down to, like, there's a timeliness factor in publishing as well. You don't want to publish your book in November because that's the most crowded month of the year. Unless it's like a new book by Tom Clancy or whatever. You learn these things, but it's also like we did a book, Soviet Daughter, about like intergenerational women that emigrated from the Soviet Ukraine and sort of how that affected their life. And we thought it was a really, really cool book. And then it just happened to publish in January of 17, which is, you know, like the month when the immigration debate was like the number one news item. And so the book did really, really well. Whereas like most other times it would have been like, well, this is a really cool book you might not have heard of. Maybe you want to check it out. But so that was just incredible dumb luck. The illustrator is very talented. It's very well written. But none of those things ultimately are what sells books. It really comes down to like the handles and how clearly they're communicated in the title and the packaging and everything else. And just
finding that
because
audience.
Yeah. And then connecting, you know, and then it's also like if you sent a book like that to like, you know, a business audience, they would be like, oh, that's cool, but it's not really for me. So you kind of have to send it to the right people.
Fair enough. All right, Joe, this has been fascinating. Great conversation. I do want to wrap up with one final question, if I could.
Sure.
So I think as these punk rock entrepreneurs, as entrepreneurs or dreamers in general, I think that we oftentimes are always sort of looking for our successes or what we're going to accomplish and always sort of projecting that success into the future. Meaning no matter what we accomplish, whether that's publishing for 22 years straight or not, it's still, we're looking at different metrics and things we want to accomplish in the future. And it's like we're never quite where we want to be. And I agree, we need to push forward. But for right now, Joe, I would love it if you could stop and turn around and look behind you at the past, I guess, 20 years at this or 22 years, sort of the highs, the lows, the wins and the losses. But tell me how you feel about the whole journey until today.
Right. That's a good question. It's like I said, the mess of it all and like the failures used to be embarrassing to me. But now I've kind of learned better and I now see every failure as like the prescriptive article. It would be like what the think piece is trying to communicate to you, but what you can only really learn by experiencing it. That, you know, and I feel like so many times I just watch company after company, entrepreneur after entrepreneur, just pump money into a bad idea. And they're not like testing the proof that what they're making is actually wanted. And I feel like that was something that was innately obvious to me, that I was like, you have to have a proof of your concept before you can scale it. And I did that by publishing zines as a teenager, even before I started Microcosm. And then I saw like what articles people responded to and what they hated and what they thought was funny and what they thought was stupid. And then going from there to like expand upon it and then sort of realizing like, okay, people really want like DIY articles and books that help them create the life they want and how to teach them how to change the world around them, because that's sort of like what everybody is after. And so looking at it with the horns and halos and seeing all of my like missteps, it's like, it's that thing where I'm like, I wouldn't really have it any other way. I have very few regrets in all of it, because when I think about it, I'm like, well, if I hadn't learned that lesson that way, I would have had to have learned it another way. It could have even been more expensive and messy and painful. And so, you know, I feel like that's part of the ride. You want to make it. And I feel like the other thing is people have a really weird tendency, and maybe this, it's just like the corporate world culture, that somebody has to fall on the sword when there's a mistake made. And I think that leads people to not being willing to admit when they screwed up or that something was their fault or that like they have regrets. And I feel like that's such a fundamental part of like doing something that you're passionate about, is that you will have missteps because you're like misguided by your passion at times. And all you can really do is like own it and move on. It's not like denying it is going to change anything, but still that's the thing that I see people do. And that's the thing that I have done mistakenly from time to time.
Beautiful answer. All right. Good Trouble is the book, Building a Successful Life in Business. We're going to say with autism. I'll link to that in the show notes for everyone. Microcosmpublishing.com is the business we've been talking about throughout this conversation. As well, Joe is on Twitter and Medium, I believe. We also talked about a bunch of other books that we'll get linked to as well. So if any of them caught your ear. They'll be in the show notes for you when you are ready for them. Joe, mm-hmm. thanks, man, so much for stopping by and sharing so openly. I really, truly do appreciate it. And I don't know, man, just keep doing what you're doing because it's awesome to watch. That conversation was a lot of fun. I hope that Joe and I didn't maybe geek out too much on punk rock and sort of that sensibility and where we feel that we've come from. But I'm assuming that lots of you out there, if not all of you, can relate to it in some way. Even if you're not into the scene of punk rock, it's this idea of doing it yourself and of creating the things that you want to create, which is ultimately entrepreneurship. So I feel that it was worth the dive into it. And yeah, I hope you dug it as much as I did. So we've reached the point in the show where we need to go back. And there was a lot covered there. There was a lot of really interesting ways I feel that we went and the way Joe sort of took the conversation. But we have to, unfortunately or fortunately, put it how you want, but we have to find just one of them. The one thing that Joe said. So let's go back. Are you ready? Let's do it. Let's find the hack.
You know, and so you have to sort of develop any product or service to sort of show the emotional payoffs to the person buying it, you know, rather than to you or your ego or to an idea that you had once. Like, you really have to make it about what the person is getting out of it.
And that's the hack. Joe. I love this. I love the simplicity of this. I love the sort of succinctness of it. And I love the absolute accuracy of this. No matter what you're developing, if it's a product, if it's a service, if it's digital and it's software, or it's a paperback book like Joe, you have to develop your product or service to show the emotional payoff to the person buying it. To your potential customer. It's not about you. It's not about your ego. It's not about sort of the bells and whistles. It's not about the features of what your product does. None of that matters. You, unfortunately, don't matter in this transaction. The emotional payoff and the way you can explain this and show this and display this to a potential customer is how you turn that person in from a prospect to a customer. Emotionally, what are they going to get out of it, right? It's the old sort of explanation we've used in business, which is nobody buys a drill bit because they want a new drill bit. They buy it because they need a hole. You're buying the hole and the end result, which is the emotional payoff. You need to get this done and you'll feel good when it's done. It doesn't matter. You don't really care that it has to be this drill bit. You're not all because this drill bit's made out of this fancy new material. That doesn't matter. You're strictly buying that. When you start to think about your products and services in this way, that it's not about your product and service, it's about that emotional payoff that they get from using it. Sell that. It's like this journey that your customer goes on. Sell that end emotional result with your product as the vehicle to take them there. Joe. Thank you so very, very much. All right. Well, that was a lot of damn fun. I'm just going to go out there and say it. Hacktheentrepreneur.com is the website. Head over there and we'll have everything that Joe talked about on the show. The email list is there. The book is there for free if you would like to go to hacktheentrepreneur.com/book. It's all there. It's all waiting for you. All right. Well, I've taken enough of your time today. I really, truly, truly, truly appreciate you stopping by. And please, until next time, keep hacking the entrepreneur.